Come into the circle of caring. Come into the community of gentleness, of justice, and love. Come, and you shall be refreshed. Let the healing power of this people penetrate you. Let loving kindness and joy pass through you. Let hope infuse you, and peace be the law of your heart. In this human circle, caring is a calling. All of us are called. So come into the circle of caring. Now is the time in our service in which we can come forward to light a candle or meditate quietly in our seats to concentrate on special events in our lives, memories, and hopes. But first, please join me in an attitude of prayer. O Spirit of life, forgive us for being careless with the hours and days we have been given. Too often we lend ourselves to unworthy ends and waste the stuff of life. Help each one of us to know that our life is precious and our choices do matter to ourselves and to one another. May we shake off the old garments that no longer fit, and may we dare to ask what does. Love us and lead us, for we want to live before we die. Amen.
My reading today is from a book by Frank O'Connor titled The Edge of Sadness. And this particular passage takes place in the life of a priest, a good man, Roman Catholic priest, and he works with the people who live in the slums, who are ill, who are in poverty, and this is his calling. And at this part of the book, he's telling us about what it's like when he's with the people who are dying. Sometimes in this moment before death, there is a kind of bubbling turbulence, and I find myself listening to words that seem to come driving out of this man. He has to tell me this story. And what is the story? It can be the oddest and most unimportant fragment from the man's past, fetched up to the surface for some unfathomable reason to completely engulf the final fading attention. I can remember that at such a moment, a man told me in tones of utmost urgency of a Laurel and Hardy movie he had once seen, Fat Oliver Discomfited by Thin Stan. Another man, in obvious pain, suddenly broke off in the middle of a groan to tell me that once, years ago in Hong Kong, he had had a dozen suits made for him. They had been cheap, but they had all been short in the arm. And an old woman whom I had thought dead suddenly popped her eyes open and said loudly, "Listen to me, Father, listen to me." And then, with great logic and lucidity, and for perhaps 2 minutes, she told me of the occasion on which she had shaken Al Smith's hand in 1928. She finished this story in a strong voice, looked at me with clear, bright eyes, and died. One can't help wondering at a time like this whether they know what's going on, whether they know that within a very few minutes they may die. Perhaps among people who have lived, as many of these people have, close to death for a long time, who have faced it obliquely every day, there is developed an instinct for postponement, like that of a child who every night delays the hour of her bedtime by standing in the center of the living room and saying desperately to her parents, "Wait, wait, wait, I want to tell you something." What's coming is coming, yes, but meanwhile, if you can just keep talking, it might not come so fast. another reaction. As I'm bending down over a bed to watch the tumbling, muttered recitation of sins, to hear what might be the last words on earth of some poor soul who for most of the years of her life has been hungry, dirty, battered, harassed, pursued, and lacerated by every sort of pain and humiliation. May now, upon suddenly realizing that all this will soon be over, shoot bolt upright on the mattress and with frightened, staring eyes and panicky lips say incredulously, "I'm not going to die, Father. I'm not really going to die." And by this question, she establishes her one last tie with most of the rest of us, because the truth seems to be that no matter how bad life has been for us, we do not leave it willingly. And this is not simply out of any uncertainty of what's to come, or a fear of punishment, or a dread of the void. When the time comes for me to go, I know that I will go with full confidence in God, but I also know that I will go with sadness. And I think for no reason other than, well, I have been alive. An old priest who was dying, one of the saintliest men I have ever known, one of those who had greatest reason to expect God's favor, many years ago surprised me by telling me with a little smile that now that he was going, he wanted desperately to stay. "A single memory can do it," he said. And I suppose he was right. The memory of an instant, of a smile, of leaf smoke on a sharp fall day, of a golden streak across a rain-washed morning, of a small boy seated alone on the seashore, solemnly building his medieval moated castles. Just this one single final flash of memory can be enough to make us want to stay forever. End of reading. Last year, around this time, your then ministerial intern, Brian Ferguson, gave a sermon titled, "What the Dead Can Teach Us About Coming Alive," which I found very stirring. In it, he quoted a poem by Julie Sopetran, and I especially, S-O-P-E-T-R-A-N, and I especially liked these words. "In that place, everything is possible. Grief battles with life, and life wins. It is once again, for a little while, happiness, playful tradition, which overcomes reality." That's how I think of the Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, as it is celebrated by our cousins to the south. Grief and life are in battle, and life wins. Happiness and playful tradition result, and for a little while, the reality of death is forgotten. Certainly, as you see, many of you have brought ofrendas, or offerings, mementos for the table here, as you did last year. And by this, you show that you wish to remember those whom you have loved and lost, and with whom you still interact in your own way. Although in our typical U.S. culture, bringing offerings, or I should say U.S. and Canadian culture, bringing offerings and mementos of loved ones we have lost to death is not something that is regularly practiced. In fact, it is only in recent years that I have officiated at memorial services in which the grieving families and friends bring photos or other artifacts for a table or for an easel display of the life of the deceased. I find it a comforting phenomenon, something that almost always leads to increased conversation amongst strangers as they look at the items on the table or the easel, and which often brings healing tears. It is not the same as celebrating the Day of the Dead, but it is a step in that direction, and I believe a healthy step. More often, our culture is like the one that Frank O'Connor described in the passage I read to you from his book, The Edge of Sadness. Now, I don't know about you, but those vignettes are not for me the edge of sadness, but they are the center of sadness. All those persons besieged by every sort of abuse, illness, and poverty. But when the time nears for them to die, they resist with every fiber of their being. I'm not going to die, Father. I'm not really going to die. And the old priest, in every way a saintly man who knew he was dying, and in his belief system, expected a heavenly welcome, but still wanted to stay here. A single memory can do it. So the avoidance of death is enmeshed in our contemporary culture, and most of the time we don't even recognize it, until we encounter a culture, as in the Dia de los Muertos, that celebrates relationship with loved ones who have died and welcomes them back at a time of the year when the barrier between life and death is legendarily thin. That expression I used a few minutes ago, those whom we have loved and lost, is a common one to us, and we use it often without much thought. If we do think about it, our emphasis would be on the loved part of the expression, and the lost part, well, is lost to our experience of the person. We have a lot of trouble with loss. Just as the characters in Frank O'Connor's book resist the loss of their lives, miserable as they are. It is essential to my work as an interim minister that I seek to enable every congregation I serve to go toward their loss rather than shrink from acknowledging and understanding it. And every congregation I serve, without exception, has experienced loss. As Lauren Mead of the Alban Institute says, the interim minister enters a church as into a house of mourning. Yes, mourning. Persons tend to cope with loss and to heal from it at different rates. That is true. But healing from loss takes extensive hard work and time. It cannot be done authentically over a couple of months. Healing requires going toward the loss, although everything in us resists this direction. And this is where I have to offer a sincere apology to everyone here who is new to this church. You have most likely heard that this church is in a transition between permanent ministers and that there was a wrenching parting from the former minister. All that is true. It is what happened before you got here. Now, it would be preferable if I could simply leave it at that for the sake of you newcomers and not continue in this vein. But what is happening here now is important also, and so it is part of your experience in this church. The congregation experienced loss on many levels, which I will mention, and the congregation is rebuilding itself. So for anyone here who is new, I just want to say what a great time to be with this church. Now I need to mention some of the losses in order for the congregation to come to terms with them. Loss of minister in December, without a chance to say goodbye to him before he left. Loss of persons in the congregation who opposed the dismissal of the minister and left. Loss of confidence in the actions of the elected leadership of the church. Loss of trust between friends who were on both sides of the issue about the minister. And most of all, loss of a sense of vital community here at First Unitarian Universalist. And with that loss came a feeling of lost opportunities for the future, halting the church's possibilities for the present. Some congregants had, some years earlier, left the church, and the December losses compounded those. As well as these grief-producing losses, other staff members left your employ to be replaced by new staff, including me, persons unknown to you, so there was additional uncertainty and loss of familiar faces and patterns. Now, even without that vital loss of community, many lay leaders sized up the situation facing the congregation. They sought to enlist as many others as they could to rebuild the congregation by providing opportunities for increasing fellowship with one another and opportunities for listening to one another as individuals, in groups, and with your consultant in meetings. They set about examining and modifying systems that did not work well. In these and in many other ways, the congregation decided to come to terms with its grave losses by rebuilding itself. So I don't mean to suggest that the congregation succumbed to loss, not at all. But some members ask for assurance that such pain can never occur again. And nobody and no system can make that assurance. But I believe it is by going through the pain of the loss that the congregation can learn where it is now, where it can go, and how it can heal from its wounds. So how does a congregation that is in pain, as this one is, go toward its loss? How does a person who is grieving go toward that loss in search of healing? I wish I had a surefire answer. I don't, but I have studied some resources, and I would like to guide you accordingly. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has a classic characterization of loss. Her best-selling book, titled On Death and Dying, was published some 40-plus years ago. The stages of coping with impending loss are, according to her, first, shock and denial, refusing to believe it. Certainly, from what you have told me, many of you experienced a visceral shock from the entire ordeal from which you have not recovered. Kubler-Ross refers to the next stage as an outpouring of anger. In her structure, it can be anger at God, at the healthcare staff, at one's family, at almost anything and anyone. I'm told that anger here was and is an emotion that many people felt and feel, and some may be stuck in anger. Being stuck there prevents people from finding the patience to understand and to come to productive outcomes. The next stages for Kubler-Ross are bargaining, often with God, depression, and acceptance of the loss. I'll leave it to you to figure out if any of those are relevant for you. A book that I have found helpful in my own grief work is by Thérèse Rando, R-A-N-D-O, titled How to Go on Living When Someone You Love Dies. Granted, the loss in this church was not caused by death, but I believe that the grief process is very similar. Rando says, quote, "The ultimate purpose of grief and mourning is to help you recognize that your loved one has gone and ultimately to adapt to the reality of that loss and to live healthfully in the new world without the deceased." Rando, throughout her book, gives a sense of hope that although complete resolution of grief at loss is not possible, loss can be accommodated and incorporated into the rest of one's life. She says that three sets of processes are necessary: acknowledging and understanding the loss, experiencing the pain and responding to the separation, and three, moving adaptively into the new life without forgetting the old. Each of these processes has its own steps, which I leave for your consideration and action. But for me, one of the most helpful and hopeful steps is called developing a new relationship with your deceased loved one. Granted, the losses faced by this church were not those of physical death, but the grieving, I believe, may be similar. Certainly, there were similarities to sudden and unexpected death, in that there was no chance for a meaningful leave-taking with the former minister or with your friends who left the church. All who are in this church today have been affected by loss of some sort. Grieving one's loss is not only a healthy thing to do, it is essential in order to heal. And healing is the purpose of everything connected with grieving one's loss. A colleague of mine has an expression that I will paraphrase for you. Grief is a door to pass on through and not a room for living in. Grief is a door to pass on through and not a room for living in. Atypical grief is grief that becomes almost comfortable, almost and certainly familiar. It can prevent persons from going forward into the healing that is the purpose of coping with loss. Think for a moment of Miss Havisham, a creation of Charles Dickens, who is so devastated by the loss of her groom on her wedding day that she closes herself off from life and wears her wedding dress every day as a reminder of her grief, a reminder to herself and to anyone else who finds her. The purpose of grief work is to heal and to find renewed life. Now, I certainly do not want to oversimplify what you have endured, neither do I have any quick fixes to offer. But I do have some ideas that can help you move forward toward loss and then through it to healing if you will work with me. Today is the opening of the congregational timeline. You'll find it out these double doors and to your left in the windows just opposite the memorial sculpture. I've taped instructions to the wall, and there is a member of the transition team standing by if you have questions. Here is what I'm asking you to do. On the pink post-it notes, please write the events or times in the life of this church when you were most proud of your church. Pink equals pride. On the green post-it notes, please write the events or the times in the life of this church when you were disappointed in your church. Green equals grumpy. And on the yellow post-it notes, and I'm so glad we ran out of those during the first service. There are more. I found more. And everyone can participate in the yellow notes, even if today is your very first time here. Please write your hopes and dreams for this church. Yellow equals yes, we can. The board took the dry run at this timeline at their meeting on Tuesday night, and I was so proud of them for making it easier for others by showing their own courage. I will have more opportunities for you to progress through loss to healing in due time, and the transition team will help you as well. Deciding how persons here will treat one another is important. Thus, a covenant of healthy relationships is needed. Designing a relevant mission statement is important, and leadership is necessary for that to happen. I am convinced that this congregation has come a long, long way from its experiences of the past several years, and especially since last December. And I am convinced that it can learn from its losses and create a brilliant future for itself. As the poet says, in the battle between grief and life, may life win. Let us support one another in this difficult, wrenching, but worthwhile journey. So may it be.
May your heart open like a flower, and may you be a blessing to all you come upon, by doing all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can.